It is estimated that 24.9 million people are enslaved around the world today. To raise awareness about this crime, President Trump declared January as the National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. The U.S. is both a source and a destination for human trafficking victims. Public awareness campaigns have raised the alarm over sex trafficking, but not undocumented minors forced into labor. A new Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America, exposes labor trafficking at an Ohio farm and the criminal network that made it possible. The documentary is from Daffodil Alton and Andreas Sadil. Trafficked was made in collaboration with the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley, and I am very pleased it brings Andreas Sadil back to Midday. Welcome.
Thank you.
So in January, you were on the show to discuss another documentary you produced, Rape on the Night Shift, and the female janitors featured in that were making speaking up before the Me Too movement. Did that movie lead to the reforms in how female janitors are treated?
Yeah, that film was part of a process of raising awareness that did lead to reforms in California. Certain California state laws were enacted to give more protections to women janitors through sexual harassment trainings, mandatory sexual harassment trainings, also creating a registry for janitorial companies so that the state can keep track of who's employing these people and can also hold them accountable. So that film was actually the genesis of Trafficked in America as well. While we were investigating abuses in the janitorial industry, we came across a case from the East Coast of some Ukrainian women who had come to this country and were being trafficked, cleaning Walmarts, Targets, big box stores, and their traffickers were taking their pay, forcing them to work, and using sexual assault as a means of coercion. So when we stumbled across that case, it opened our eyes to this issue of labor trafficking that was pretty much right in front of our face for our last two films, and didn't really realize what we were looking at. Labor trafficking is something that's very difficult to see because the work often is legal in itself. So, for instance, if you see a janitor mopping a floor, you don't necessarily see a problem. That mm-hmm. could be a person who's being employed correctly, or they can be being trafficked. So as we started to investigate this phenomenon, as was mentioned at the top of the show, that labor trafficking is a worldwide phenomenon, but it's not very well understood or seen here in the U.S. So we decided to take a look at this topic and chose a particular case of Guatemalan teenagers who were trafficked here in this country.
And how did you first become aware of, obviously, you know, you discovered through your Lost Project all kinds of issues in the American labor force with regards to forced labor, but how did you get on this specific track with these Guatemalan minors?
Well, that was during a process of research in which we were looking at the more well-known cases of labor trafficking. Most trafficking cases are sex trafficking cases, and we can talk more about why that is. But while we were looking at the relatively small number of labor trafficking cases that have been brought by the federal government, we got a press release about this case in which some traffickers had recently been sentenced in Marion, Ohio. We looked at the press release. I had had some experience reporting on the egg industry for a previous film, Rape in the Fields. Mm-hmm. We started to look into it and noticed that there was something distinct about this case in that it also involved unaccompanied minors coming from Central America. So because it was happening now, because it had this added element of unaccompanied minors coming in, we decided to look into it more, and it turned into a two-year-long research project.
Wow. So on the big picture, do you think that President Trump making January the National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month is at least a start at bringing awareness to this issue?
Anything's a start at this point.
Yeah.
Labor trafficking is so misunderstood at this time. I think one of the things that the White House previous administration had done is create a White House Advisory Council on Human Trafficking in which human trafficking survivors have come together to advise the president and his policies. So that's been a big step forward. Human trafficking is something that needs to be looked at from all kinds of different angles, not just law enforcement, but also social services. And so these survivors who have gone through the experience bring a great perspective to the advising that goes on. So that's one aspect. What we're hoping to do with this piece is start to get more stories out in the press. I think one of the things that maybe your listeners are aware of are Thai fishermen being enslaved on shrimp boats, mm-hmm. or child labor in West Africa on cocoa plantations. These are all stories that we've heard about happening overseas. But what we're trying to do is put a lens on what's happening right here in this country. Some of the very few studies that have been done on labor trafficking in this country, particularly one that was funded by the National Institute of Justice, estimates that as many as 40% of all undocumented workers in the United States have been subjected to labor trafficking. So if you take a number of about 11 million undocumented immigrants, we're talking potentially millions of people who are being labor trafficked right now. But you don't see the press coverage, you don't see the prosecutions, and it's happening right in front of our faces.
You know, how much of that, the fact that you don't see so much of the press and it's right in front of our faces, how much of that speaks to perhaps our country's relationship to work, to labor?
Well, that's really, that's the underlying question. I mean, it's not hyperbole to say that this country's economy was founded on labor trafficking. Slavery has been, was constitutional law here for hundreds of years, and cheap labor has been the law of the land since. Now, obviously, slavery has been abolished. Debt peonage has been abolished. But the hunger for cheap labor is still there. One of the problems that we see, whether it's in the agricultural industry, the janitorial industry, the construction industry, which are among the top three industries where we see labor trafficking, is that there has been a move from companies having direct employees doing the work to hiring out contractors to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, several things get set in motion, including a distance between the employer and what happens with the actual workers. And then the contractors will often, sometimes they'll hire people who may have papers or not. They're pledging to the company that these people do have papers, but that's where a lot of the unaccountability takes place, within the contractor sphere. So that's happening across industries in this country. The service sector is another one. So our whole economy, with its demand for cheap food and cheap services, relies on cheap labor to keep it going.
I'm D.W. Gibson. I'm speaking with Andreas Sedilla about the latest Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America. You guys do such a good job with this film in terms of not only presenting the issue, but giving us a narrative we can really latch on to. And we start in Guatemala with these families and the places from which they depart. So talk to us about how these teens are lured away from their homes.
Well, it's really a very classic immigrant story in terms of we went back to the village where most of these unaccompanied minors came from. And this is a very small, impoverished village, remote in the highlands of Guatemala. People there are doing subsistence farming, not really participating in the cash economy, or if they are, they're earning about a dollar a day. They don't have good schooling. They don't have good health care. There's not a lot of opportunities for them and their families for the future. And it's basically a struggle to get by every day. When we were talking to the mother of one of these teens and we're asking her, what do you guys eat for breakfast? Her response was, well, when we have money, we eat breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
But when we don't have money, we don't eat breakfast. So in that type of poverty, the opportunity to be able to leave and come to the United States to make money to support your family is something that is hard to pass up, even for a 14-year-old boy. So in this case, a local recruiter in the town who was a neighbor or a distant relative had been smuggling people up into the United States for years, getting them jobs. And at this particular moment in 2014, when this all started, there was a surge of unaccompanied minors coming from Central America. And they were overwhelming the federal government, who was having a hard time processing all these teens. So the smuggler recruiter in Guatemala recognized this and began offering the teens in the village the opportunity to come to the United States, saying, now's the time to come. If you want to come, we can get you through easily. And that's what he did. He basically charged them a fee of $15,000, which, of course, they don't have, so right. They give up the deed to their house as collateral, and arrange for them to be smuggled up into the United States. Once they got to the U.S. border, they were detained, and as minors, they were released to sponsors who were supposed to take care of them, make sure they went to school as they awaited their hearing. In this case, the sponsor was associates of the smugglers. So the federal government then just turned the kids back over to the traffickers who put them to work at the Ohio hemp farm.
Which is tremendous. Isn't the Department of Health and Human Services supposed to vet sponsors?
Well, that's exactly right. And they do have a vetting process. But during the surge, they became so overwhelmed that they started to relax their policies. So certain things about making sure that certain background checks were being conducted and verifying the identities of sponsors, all those safeguards were then relaxed as the government was just releasing teens as quickly as possible. I mean, you have to understand one of the reasons why they're releasing the teens is because they don't want, first of all, they can't house them, nor do they want to be placing them in some sort of detention that feels like prison. They want mm-hmm. the kids out of their custody so that they can be with a relative, so that they can go to school. That's the intention. But in this case, everything went wrong. And it wasn't just the Ohio case. There was other cases where this was mishandled. The Senator Portman from Ohio, who held a hearing looking into the failures of HHS 2 years ago, he will now be holding a new hearing this week to follow up and see what HHS has been doing to rectify this.
Has your reporting demonstrated that there have been any changes thus far, or still awaiting changes in policy there?
From the research that we've done, there seems to have been some changes on paper, and it's not clear what's actually happening on the ground. Some of the things that did happen prior to the hearing was that they did begin to strengthen some of their vetting procedures again. One of the more notable changes they made involved flagging when multiple requests as a sponsor are coming from the same address.
Got it.
So, for instance, in this case, what happened was the traffickers were requesting sponsors, and they all had the same address. So it was, you know, 6-8 kids going to the same trailer in the same trailer park. So that should have been a red flag. So why are all these kids going to this same trailer? Well, that's one of the policies that now HHS has implemented, is to flag those types of situations.
So talking about scope in terms of the story that you zone in on for this film, how many victims were forced into labor?
In this case, there were 10 victims who were listed in the federal indictment. 8 of them were minors. But the indictment itself refers to the fact that there were likely many more, as many as 30.
Yeah.
And when we did our reporting on the ground, we met people, some who were part of the same process, who weren't named in the indictment either. So it's unclear how big this particular case is. But I think it's noteworthy that there are likely many, many more cases just like this. This case would have never have come to light if it weren't for one teenager who was fed up, didn't want to do this work anymore, was complaining. His parents were being threatened back home with death. And yet, despite all this, he was able to reach out to a relative who got in touch with law enforcement. That set into motion a chain of events which eventually led to a raid and their rescue.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an extremely unusual situation for a human trafficking victim to be able to reach out for help while they're being abused.
Right.
And nobody else in the case did. So it's unclear how many other cases like this are happening right now and people aren't speaking up.
And the youngest in the case that you focus in on was 14, yes?
That's correct. Yeah, 14. You know.
So, describe the living conditions that individual and others were living in when they arrived in Marion County, Ohio.
Well, that was one of the most abhorrent parts of these cases. This case. I mean, lots of people come here to work, and they come expecting to work, and they come expecting to do hard work, but treated fairly. These kids were being stuffed into a trailer. We heard as many as 8 or 10. In a three-bedroom trailer, which had no running water, no heat, and no air conditioning. So now you imagine you're in Ohio without those services.
Right.
One of the trailers that we went into actually had a trap door in the kitchen floor, and there was evidence that people had been sleeping on the ground under the trailer. There were bed mattresses. There was little curtains between them. So they were stuffed in. They were sleeping in closets. So it was an awful situation. They didn't have running water to wash their clothes,
uh-huh.
And they didn't have much food to eat either. The trafficker was taking basically all of their money. I think we heard accounts of living off $50 a week. So they basically ate, a cup of noodles from the gas station for all their meals.
And are there movements, daily movements, monitored by the trafficker? I mean, how tightly are they physically held?
In this case, yeah. So the trailer was actually owned by the trafficker, and then they were assigned to different work crews who would come and pick them up around 4 o'clock in the morning. They'd be taken straight to work. Where they could work anywhere from 12 to 16-hour days, and then they were driven back to their trailer. And this is in a very rural, remote part of Ohio. If they had wanted to go anywhere, there wouldn't be anywhere to go. They would have to walk about 10 miles to get to Marion proper, down a desolate country road. And as an undocumented, scared immigrant who's being threatened, they weren't going to do that, so they just they put up with it. But they were every aspect of their life was being controlled.
I'm speaking with Andres Cedillo about his latest Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Andres Cedillo about his new documentary, Trafficked in America, for Frontline. So, Trium Farms is where the teens were forced to work and produce more than 10 million eggs a day, which is just mind-boggling, at various farms around central Ohio. Did the employer know that the Guatemalan teens were basically enslaved at their plants?
We interviewed the executive vice president, and he insists that they did not know. His position is that he hired a contractor to do work, and this contractor then hired out subcontractors who actually brought in the crews in which the teens were working. The teens did what were called bird services, so they did everything from debeaking chickens to vaccinating to removing and exterminating old chickens. And so that work was, as a contract job, the company says they didn't supervise the work. They supervised that the work got done. So it's much the same as if, for instance, you were to hire a plumber to come fix your leak. You're concerned is that the leak gets fixed and you're not paying attention to what else is happening. So the company has said repeatedly that they did not know this was going on. They cooperated with federal authorities when they came in to do the raid, and then they fired the contractor who had been bringing in the work.
Had the company been working with other subcontractors for a long time, or was this trafficker's their first encounter with a subcontractor?
My understanding is that they had been working with contractors and subcontractors in the past.
Okay.
This particular contractor, Pablo Duran Sr., who ended up hiring the subcontractors who had the kids, had come from a previous company that had been owned by Jack DeCoster, who had decades of violations against him, everything from environmental violations to women being sexually assaulted at his plant to all kinds of worker abuses. Jack DeCoster's facilities were responsible for one of the biggest salmonella outbreaks in history back in 2010. So this contractor had come from Jack DeCoster's facilities and then moved over to Trillium when Jack DeCoster sold his business to Trillium.
So even if Trillium didn't know about the slave labor, they did know about the working conditions, yes? And what did they say about those?
Well, the work is hard. You know, there's no way around it. It's a dirty job, and the work is extremely difficult to do.
You have some footage from the egg farm. Was that from one of the Guatemalan teens?
No, that there's footage that Trillium sent us of the inside of their plants. They wouldn't allow us to film inside their plants. So one of the things that we did is we collected some of the very hard to access footage inside plants, some of which had been taken by animal rights groups that had gone undercover. So we used those images to help illustrate what was being described to us as the conditions inside the farm.
One worker says that the manure falls in your eyes while working there. The conditions really do just sound hellish. What time did shifts begin and end? Talk about how long they worked.
Well, the kids that, in this case, would often get picked up at their trailer 4 in the morning, and sometimes they would get back at 6 in the evening, 9 in the evening, sometimes as late as midnight. So extremely long shifts. 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week, not time off, certainly not going to school.
Mm-hmm. And you told us a little bit about the gentleman who was running the subcontracting outfit, Pablo. Tell us a little bit more about his story. Is he a U.S. citizen?
Pablo Duran is a naturalized U.S. citizen. So he originally came to this country from Mexico. He is part of a large family that had been working in agriculture in the Midwest for decades. And he moved over and started working as the primary labor contractor for bird services at the Ohio operations.
And, you know, you open the film in a remarkable way to really underscore, I think, this point that it's sort of out there in front of us all and we don't really see it under our own eyes. You talked to Pablo's son. Tell us a little bit about him and his perspective.
Well, yeah, there was we were able to track down members of Pablo Duran Sr.'s family to hear from them. And one of the themes of this is that even being so close to what's happening, you're not always clear that some crime is being committed. Let me try to explain. A lot of the forms of labor trafficking in this country, again, if you look at the labor trafficking happens in almost every industry that you can imagine. Polaris, which runs the National Human Trafficking Hotline, has broken them down, the industries, into 25 major categories, four of which the biggest ones are agricultural, construction, janitorial, restaurants, also domestic work. Mm-hmm. And these are all professions that are legal. So, for instance, if you were to separate this from sex trafficking, where sex work, which is a type of labor, the work itself is illegal. So it's very easy to spot, relatively easy to spot, if somebody's doing sex work, that there might be a problem there. But if you're working in construction or if you're working in a restaurant, there's nothing overt that's going to say to you, we have a problem here. So in some of these cases, you could be right next to it. It could be the janitor who's cleaning your office. It could be the person who's chopping your onions. It could be anybody that you're interacting on a daily basis, and not know what are the underlying conditions of their labor. The labor itself might be legal, but if they're being forced to do it or coerced in some way, that's where the legal thing is happening, and that's what's hard to spot. So in this case, some members of Pablo Durán's family didn't even know that this was going on.
It also just underscores how little we interact with the people that we share space with on a daily basis, right? The people we see, how little we actually speak with them. Pablo Durán, you met him in Mexico, so he'd run away to Mexico, and you actually got him there to talk to you. But shortly thereafter, he was arrested, right?
That's correct. We had been looking for him during the Costa Rica investigation, and we finally made contact with him and were able to interview him in Mexico City. And you know, he denied knowledge of that kids had been working on the crew, that the living conditions. He contradicted a lot of the allegations made against him in the indictment. And he eventually tried to come back into this country, and he was detained at the border, and he's currently in federal custody.
And does he have a trial date set, or what's the timeline there in terms of his fate?
There's no trial date set yet. He's facing several counts of forced labor, going up to about 20 years. He's, I believe, in his late 40s, so we're waiting to see if he's going to fight the charges and go to trial, or if he'll try to cooperate with the government.
I'm D.W. Gibson. I'm speaking with Andreas Sodil about his latest frontline documentary, Trafficked in America. So Araldo Castillo Serrano was one of the ringleaders. What kind of tactics did he use to threaten the families of these teens in Guatemala? I mean, there was the deed you mentioned, but what else?
Yeah, so, you know, there's lots of different ways that people can coerce someone else to doing their bidding. In this case, as you mentioned, he had the deeds to their homes, but he resorted to outright threats of physical violence. So if kids complained that they weren't getting enough money, or the working conditions weren't good, or the living conditions weren't good, he simply threatened them with violence, violence against them or against their families back home. This is an extremely common tactic. You know, when we, for a previous film, interviewed the director at the FBI in charge of the Human Trafficking Unit in the Civil Rights Division, he explained very clearly that all of us are vulnerable to this type of coercion. It doesn't take much more than a threat to a loved one to get you to do what somebody else wants you to do. Mm-hmm. So very simple threats of violence can be extremely compelling to make people do things against their will.
And also, you know, you speak to Castillo Serrano's mother, and that's such an effective part of the film, I think, because it speaks to some sort of normalization, perverse normalization that takes place in these communities. She was sort of proud of her son's work and thought he was doing good things, no?
Yeah, no, it was extremely revealing to be in the village itself. As you know, I mentioned earlier, the trafficker, Araldo Castillo, was not too distantly related to some of his neighbors who he was smuggling into the United States. Again, if you think about being so isolated in this remote village with so few opportunities, and somebody gives you the opportunity to leave and make a better life for yourself and help your family, that can be considered a good thing. And many immigrants come here with that dream. What went wrong here is the greed and the violence that Castillo showed to the people that he was saying he was helping. So that was the, as you say, the perverse part of what happened here. He could have, many people come here and work and live dignified lives and send money back home to help their loved ones. But in this case, they were trapped. The mother, as you mentioned, had been holding on to the deeds, which she eventually gave back. When Araldo Castillo was being sentenced, the federal judge delayed his sentencing telling Castillo that he should return the deeds. If he were to return the deeds, he would get a short sentence, and that's what he did. He was facing 75 years. He got 15. So the mother in the village went back and gave the deeds back to all the families.
And just because it's so complicated across, you know, countries and continents, how was the court able to confirm that she had, in fact, given back the deeds?
That's a great question. We were able to do some reporting to find a lawyer in Guatemala who was an invaluable resource to us, who had basically raised his hand as a friend of the court. He is... been doing work specifically in these communities. You have to imagine these are primarily indigenous communities where, you know, this is a two-day travel from Guatemala City through the mountains where, you know, every hour that you go from village to village, they're speaking another language. Mm-hmm. So he had been doing work in these communities, knew them well. He himself was a lawyer, and he offered his assistance. And he went back and went and did his best work to try to verify that the deeds had been returned. He was able to verify with certainty that about half of them had been, but it was because of the legal system and the real estate law there, he wasn't able to verify all of them.
Interesting. An important chain, link in the fence, rather. Trillium Farms says they were paid by Pablo Duran and another unnamed person $6 million. So what did they believe they were paying for?
So they had a contract with Pablo Duran's company to perform these services. So the services that they were paying for were these bird services. So the company would say to Pablo Duran's company, you know, you will get paid X dollars for every truckload of chickens that are debeaked or something along those lines. And there was a lot of work to do. And the work got done. And over the course of this three-year deal, Trillium paid Pablo Duran's company $6 million, that, according to the federal documents.
And you spoke with a man named Bartolo who was serving jail time for helping in this scheme. What was his role?
Bartolo Dominguez was one of the defendants in the case. He maintains that he was one of the subcontractors, and he maintains that he was simply a driver who would pick up the crews and go and take them to the farms. The allegations against him were that he was harboring aliens, but he denies knowing that the teens were being mistreated in any way. So he was sentenced to time in federal prison and was subsequently deported.
It's truly remarkable how all parties involved in the film really disavow any sort of knowledge or even sighting of the workers and what their lives were like. It's quite remarkable. How many involved in the conspiracy have been convicted?
Six people have gone to prison, now Pablo Duran Sr. is in custody. And that's the extent of the criminal conspiracy per the government's case at this time.
And quickly, what's happened to the teenagers who were forced into slave labor? Have you been able to track any of their stories?
So the teenagers that we were able to track down were placed in federal foster care. And so some of them are in school. Some of them have graduated. Some of them are working. And to the best of our knowledge, the majority of them have received T visas. Those are special victims. Those are special visas for victims of trafficking.
I've been speaking with Andreas Cedillo about his latest Frontline documentary, Trafficked in America. It's airing tomorrow night at 10 p.m. on WNET. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.